became as Clarence Sedan. He turned right around and sat on the platform just like he'd be sitting there. And I took my Bible and I started reading texts about God's way of salvation. Every time I'd read one like John 5 or 24, that's it, he says, that's what happened. He didn't mind the crowd looking on, because he was quite a notable character in town. So Clarence had gotten sick. He said, now the first thing I gotta get is a Bible. I spoke to him about, no, not a Bible in our house. He said, well, keep on. James said, not a Bible in our house. I gotta get a Bible. So the next day he went up and he bought a Bible for about $1. Out of one of the stores, of course, he about $3 now. So he bought this Bible and started to read. Well, he hadn't been in school very much. He wasn't very well educated, as you can imagine, a man of his kind. So I remember this night, Father Chappell and Mrs. Chappell and I pulled up, and here was Clarence standing up at the top of the steps, in the church steps, with a great big grin on his face and a big Bible under his arm. He was the happiest fellow you ever saw. Just as we got to the top of the steps, he says, Brother Wilson, he says, you know what? I really enjoying my Bible. He said, I was reading over there in the 25th of Matthew about those foolish Virginians. They were foolish virgins, you know, the five foolish virgins. But he says they were foolish Virginians. He couldn't read very well. Well, I said, Clarence, your theology won't go so good over the border. You better not go up to Virginia and preach like that. So then the next night he came to me, he says, you know, he said, I'm reading about Gutis Cascaret denying the law. And, of course, there was some medicine back in there they used to call Cascaret. But that's the way Clarence would read. But I'm going to tell you today, that man's a trick. He's alive today. And I was in Raleigh a few years ago, just before I came down to Albany, and they said so many people came in from the surrounding territory where we had meetings those days, that the chapel said, let's have a get-together. And let all those folks who were saved in your meetings had around here come in. We'll have some refreshments and just to get together. I said, that would be nice. So they did. So Clarence was there, and he said to Mr. Chapman, he said, I'd just like to have a little time tonight. And Chapman, that'll be fine. So when his time came, he got up. He opened his Bible. He said, folks, he said, I'm going to start with this, for I don't have the card with me. He said, there's the card, he said, that was the cause of my going to those meetings. He said, when I read that card on the front porch that night, and read about those meetings, and decided I was going to go, he said, that was what led me, and especially, he said, these words down here, there'll be no collection taken at these persons. Well, that card was yellow by this time, and after the meeting, he said, would you like to have this, Mr. Wilson? I said, I certainly would. So I have it in one of my choice collections. So that was some of the experiences there in Clayton, where the Lord saved some 51 precious souls at that time. I think we'll conclude with that and possibly continue next Wednesday night. I might say this, however, when we'll leave Clayton, that the first time I had the opportunity of teaching, all I was doing was preaching the gospel. I wasn't too interested in teaching Christians. But these young converts insisted that they be taught. So Mr. Chappell practically arranged the meeting, and the next Saturday afternoon we'll go over for a Bible reading, and I had never taught Christians, I just preached the gospel. And he said, Mr. Wilson, you've got to take this meeting. I said, you're not talking to me, I'm not teaching, I'm not a teacher. I'm just a gospel preacher. No, he said, these are your converts, you've got to teach. I said, Jimmy, I wouldn't know how to start. Well, he said, you've got to start. And I tried my best to get him to take the meeting. When we got there, and all I could think about was John 10:27-28. I give unto my sheep eternal life, they shall never perish. Neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand. My Father which gave them is greater than all, and no man is able to pluck them out of my Father's hand. We sang a couple of choruses, and then prayer, and I said, well, let's open our Bibles, and I turned to that verse. That was my first experience, I'll never forget, at teaching young days. Started off, I've never spoken on it before, I didn't have any notes or anything. My sheep, now that's ownership. I said, here's a boy, and that's his bicycle, and that's mine. Girl, she has a little dog, and that's my dog. What a pride there is in saying it's mine. Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 10. Proverbs 23 and 10. But ye know the way that I take. When ye have tried me, I shall come forth as gold. We'll bring that text in and I'll show you a little later on why we read it. Proverbs 23 and 10. 23. Oh, excuse me, what's wrong with me? Job 23 and 10. Now, this is getting serious. I forgot to pick someone up last Wednesday night. I started on the wrong words tonight and gave out the wrong text. I'll show you one thing to stop your imagination from running riot. I'm not in love. Joel chapter 23 and verse 10. Sometimes I get Joel's problems and stuff. Job 23 and 10. But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. Of the last four Wednesday nights, we've been speaking about how the Lord led in reference to our exercise for the ministry and our coming down south. And last week, if I remember correctly, we stopped at Raleigh, North Carolina, how the Lord led there and what the Lord did. How we had that one campaign in Clayton, how the Lord so remarkably led into our taking that campaign alone, and how he came in and wonderfully blessed, and then he was saved, and that was the beginning of my launching out single-handed, although I did have a couple of campaigns that were mentioned in the middle of two with the same brother that I came out with, Brother Fred Newton. But the desire of my heart as a young Christian, and especially after the Lord put the burden on our hearts for souls, for precious souls, that seemed to be the consuming passion of my heart. Until one night, and the Lord taught me a lesson that has stayed with me, frankly, ever since. During that campaign in Clayton, I think it was the night seven had stayed back and confessed Christ and poured up the land. That was a lot for me to be saved. Just starting out, there were 51 during these 5 weeks, but the night the seven stayed back and spoke of them saved. Instead of rejoicing as I thought I would, I didn't rejoice. I somehow went home heavy-hearted. The folks I was riding in couldn't ride with in the car, the chapel, they couldn't understand my being so quiet. But somehow I just felt heavy-hearted and hollow-hearted. I couldn't understand it myself. So I went immediately to my bedroom on getting home. As I did, I threw myself across the bed, and it was right at the window. And I asked the Lord why it was that I wasn't happy over the blessing, you see. And I looked up and looked out the window, and looking right down, it seemed on me, was a full moon. The moon was full. And as you know, sometimes they claim they can see a face in the moon. Well, it just seemed to me as though the Lord was looking right down. And this was the message that seemed to come to me right there. It's not service, even fruitful service, that truly satisfies the heart of a Christian. It's only Christ. I learned that lesson that night. That if you saw 1,000 saved, that wouldn't fully satisfy you. It'd make you happy. But service cannot replace the master. No matter how you engage in service, or how much you are blessed in your service, only the Lord Jesus Christ can be satisfied. Because if your service is not fruitful, and at times you have a barren period, if your joy depends upon your fruitful service, you're going to be unhappy. Because if you're not seeing much done for the Lord, then you're not going to be very joyful in the Lord. But if you're occupied with Christ, even though you don't see much being done in the way of fruit in your labors, the Lord Jesus doesn't care. And therefore you have Him, and He only truly satisfies. I never will forget that night, and it taught me a lesson that I have profited from unto this day. Another experience I had in Raleigh, as we told you, we stayed with the chapel at 1909 Sunset Drive, Raleigh. And one morning while we were sitting there chatting,
Mrs. Chappell said, Wilson, you know, it's a strange thing that he started building this home the same month that you got saved up in Canada, 6 years ago. And you know, since that time, Jimmy and I have been praying for God to send us a preacher. We made that room that you're sleeping in, we made that room a prophet's chamber. We really didn't need an extra room, we had two other bedrooms, but decided one night we were going to build an extra room on the house. That was going to be the prophet's chamber. And from that time till now, we have been praying that the Lord would send us a young preacher to occupy that room and make this his headquarters. You know, we've had a lot of preachers come through. Of course, he says most of them haven't married men, and we didn't see if we could invite them. Then she said there were a couple of single preachers came through, but one of them was so Scotch that people wouldn't understand. And the other one was Irish, and they didn't think that his type preaching would quite suit the people in North Carolina. So she said, Jimmy and I, last night, we talked it all over, and we felt that you were the one the Lord had sent to occupy that room. Now she said, it's up to you to accept with all your debt. You may have that room, stay here as long as you like, and that'll be your room, and you can have your meals here, and it won't cost you a penny. You want to make this your headquarters. I stayed there for 3 years. And the chapels were just like parents to me, and as the Bible says, as you forsake of father and mother, the same shall find father and mother. And I certainly found the father and mother in Mr. and Mrs. Jason Chapel of Raleigh, North Carolina. So that is a very unusual thing and another indication of the leading of the Lord. Well, about that time, Mr. Nugent wrote down saying there was a Bible conference in Newport News, Virginia, over New Year's, and would I like to go along? I said, yes, I would like to go along to the conference. So he came through Raleigh and picked me up, and we went on down to Newport News for the Bible conference, a very large conference. It was held in the Warwick Hotel. We used the big auditorium in the hotel, and of course all the citizens and folks who came from afar stayed in the hotel and occupied about all the rooms, while the local citizens in Newport News were quite a number of them, and they did take some into their homes, visited. But at that conference, there were a lot of men. I suppose I was the youngest preacher there, and there were about 25 or 30 of them. Most of them were old pioneers, men that you wouldn't know if I mentioned their names, like the Bradford, Mr. McEwen, and so on. Men who had been preaching the gospel for 30 and 40 and 50 years. So one night, Mr. Nugent and myself were having supper. It was just before the Sunday night service. And one of the men in charge of the conference came over and said, we'd like you two men to preach tonight. And I said, yeah, pray it. No, he said, we want you to preach too. I said, no, I don't want to preach. He said, well, just trust the Lord. That's it, just trust the Lord. So that was it. Well, I had just started my supper. I think I'd taken about four bites. I didn't take another one. I thought I was about to lose the four I'd already taken. So I had to get up from the table and go up to my room in the hotel, and I'll assure you I was scared to death. I knew the audience would be there that night, especially all the veteran preachers, and here I was, the youngest one in the crowd. So I set my time in my room, and finally Fred came up to my room and decided to encourage me to go ahead. When I walked up on that platform and looked out on that audience and saw these two front rows that lined with these gray-haired veterans of the Word, I felt like saying, well, now, I'd appreciate it very much that I could flap my wings a whole lot better if you'd rather slip off and have a prayer meeting for me somewhere in one of these rooms. But nevertheless, the Lord, in His grace, came in and gave help on that occasion. So after that experience in the Newport News, they asked us and urged us to stay for a series of meetings, which we did, and we preached for 6 weeks in the chapel in Newport News, and then I went back to Raleigh, and they were down there, especially among those local places where we had been preaching. So summertime go on, and another thing had happened back in Canada. As I told you, my parents more or less depended on me when I left them and I came south, depending upon the Lord only, with no salary of any kind, with no promise from anyone for a penny, just the living God in heaven to meet my need. Well, I left in July, and in December my father fell and broke his hip. Riding his bicycle to work on the icy road, his bicycle went out from under him and he broke his hip, and his working days were over. When I got news of that, it just simply meant that it was up to me to shoulder that responsibility financially, which I thought to do. Thought to do from that day on. So then the time came when I thought it was time for us to go home. In fact, Fred was wanting to go up to Canada, and we went on up to Canada to see our folks, and from there we went over to Chicago, and Mr. Kennedy, who was here last Sunday morning, Jim Kennedy, he was one of the first men I met there in that big chapel, Roberts Memorial, one of the largest in Chicago, and we met Mr. Kennedy at that time, and I've known him ever since. He's a real companion, a real prayer partner. So we had this 7-week campaign in the big Roberts Memorial Church in Chicago, and then we came back down to Raleigh. Well, after the blessing we had seen in Newport News, the brethren there wanted us, Mr. News and I, to come back and operate the tent in the summer, so we did. We went back and had 8 weeks of meetings right in Newport News in the big tent. Well, that was the last campaign that Fred and I were together. The Lord came in and lots of people were saved. Crowds came every night, and a couple of times Carlos came down from Raleigh, down to Newport News, distance of a couple of hundred miles. Fred said to me one night, he said, Lester, why are they coming down from Raleigh? Well, the reason they were coming down from Raleigh was they wanted me to come back to Raleigh. They thought possibly I was going to stay down in Newport News. Well, to tell you the truth, I was caught between two currents. I thought a lot of Fred Nugent, and we had seen a lot of blessing together, and yet I felt that God had taught me a lesson, as I mentioned last week, that my place of labor was in North Carolina. So I told Fred, I said, Fred, they want me back in North Carolina, and I think I'll go. Well, he didn't seem to like it very well, but anyway, we decided to return. A couple of days later, I was to leave on the boat that went across from Newport News to Norfolk, get the train on back to Raleigh, and Fred and I stood on the dock there. This is where my text comes in. Fred said, Lester, when are you coming back? Join us. I said, Fred, I just can't say. Well, he said, I believe, if I know anything, I believe the Lord teamed us up together. I believe he brought us together, labored together in the Lord's work. He said, I think possibly the Christians from Raleigh are leading you out of the Lord's path. Well, Fred, I said, the word says this, he knoweth the way that I take. And that's the next letter. He said, do you know the rest of that text? I said, no, I don't. Not by my hand. Well, he said, this is the rest. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. He said, if you're in the Lord's will, true, he knows the way that he takes. But you're going to be fine. He said, I'm sorry you're going to leave me, but I enjoyed being with you and we had a happy time together. And I'm sorry you're going, and I think you're making a mistake. Once again, I said, Fred, he knoweth the way that I take. And so by this time, I went on to the boat and left him standing there in the dock. We thought a lot of each other, and still did until I left here, as you know, 3 or 4 years ago. Went to Canada and took the news and funeral. But after that, the Lord so blessed us back in North Carolina that Fred Nugent was such a godly man, a man who feared God, that he could see that I had chosen the right path. Afterwards, we met many times scattered in his home. We moved back to Canada, and we realized that I was in the Lord's building going back to Raleigh, the day the Lord had blessed. So then we went back to the chapel, the place I referred to a little while ago. But there was an experience that happened in Newport News. It'll be well to refer to strengthen your faith, because in those days, the Lord was strengthening mine, putting me into experiences that increased my faith. Now, I remember this experience. Board day came. As I was staying with Mr. and Mrs. Newton at that time, I used to pay them $7.50 a week was $15 for 2 weeks. So I used to pay every 2 weeks. Well, before day came, when I got up that morning, I had $3 in my pocket. So I did some praying. I told the Lord I needed $15 that day. And the mailman came and he left and he didn't leave anything except a card. And on that card it was that a parcel was down at the postal office for me. And it says carrying charges, gave the price of the parcel $2.72. Postal charges or carrying charges extra. I said to Fred, what does that mean? He said, it means if it's been there after so many days, you pay so much per day for staying down. I was, oh my. I didn't tell him, he didn't know what I was a millionaire. I had $3 in my pocket and board there. And I thought of all days for this thing to come along. So we went on down to the postal office and he said, arguably, I said, no, he failed in the car because I didn't know what to do. If it was more than $3, I didn't want him to see that I just had $3. I'd have to left it there. I said, no, I said, you stay in the car. I won't see you in there. No, he said, I'll do it. So he came in. And I handed the clerk the check, the card, looked at it, and then got the copy of a bunch of books I had in my mother's came down here. I said, how much owe you? He said, $2.72. I said, no carrying charges. No, he said, hasn't hit 5 days. Oh, I thought that's fine. And 28 cents left. Still bored. So then something else goes at me a minute or two later. Fred says, you know, tonight, children's night. He used to have children's night on Friday night, I think it was. He'd have about 100 children from us. One of us would speak to the children, the other would speak to the adult rappers. He used to treat them. Every Friday night, we give the youngsters something to eat. And it used to cost us about $1 a piece, about $2. Oh, I thought, I got 23 and children. So he said, when we get the kids tonight? I said, I don't know, sir. Let's go over to 5 and 10 cents store. First thing in my mind. So we went over to 5 and 10 cents store, and just we walked in, right in face to face with the candy counter, and all I saw there was a great big case full of these chips wrapped up in paper. And I saw on 10 cents a pound, and my mind began working pretty quick. I got 10 cents a pound, 5 pounds, and 50 cents, 25 cents for him, 25 cents for me. And I said to the girl, I said, how many of those pounds? If she raised them up, there's about 40 in a pound. That's 200. That's 250 chips. I just said, that's all right. He talked to me, he said, well, I guess you'll be all right. I said, sure, that's plenty. Okay. He said, all right. So I hand over my quarter, and I think that's it. Well, we had the meeting that night, and I was still thinking about O.J. 3 pennies in my pocket. After the meeting, a brother by the name of John Lloyd, he came up to me, and his brother wrote to me, he said, here's a letter. He said, I forgot to give it to you last night. He said, I did it to you last night, but he said, I brought it tonight. Well, he knew what I thought of him. Because I got the letter, and as soon as I got an opportunity, I opened it, and it was $15. So that was about 9:30 that night, and I paid my board on board debt. Not until the Lord had reduced me to 3 pennies. But they were one of the experiences I had in Newport News, the Lord was speaking to me and to strengthen our faith. Well, I see our time's about up, half past, and I'm not going to go over this time. So next week, we'll continue on the Lord's leading to get back to Raleigh and see what is there, and then after that, we'll go all over to Winston, Salem, and end up, I suppose, about 6 weeks from now down here in Alton. As we go through chapter by chapter of chapter of He, Leader, Me. Showing that God is the same today as He was 2,000 years ago or 4,000 years ago. He still leads the people. He still meets their needs. He tests them, He tries them. God requires a simple, childlike faith. And we'll find out, although it's true, He knows the way that I take, that when you have tried me, I shall come forth with you. the trials are to that end, that he might come forth with gold. Gold is that which speaks of that which abides and stands the fire. You know, you read in Corinthians, here's the Christian's life brought into the view, and the one man has wood, hay, and stubble, and all is up in smoke. And maybe plenty of wood, plenty of hay, plenty of stubble. It looks big and pretentious. The poor man, then it's put in the fire, nothing but ashes left. That's the life of some Christians. But what is it that abides the fire? Wood, hay, and stubble is what burns, is burnt up in the fire. Gold, silver, precious stones. These are the things that abide the fire. And the fire in that case is the presence of God. For our God is a consuming fire. He has consumed everything that's not done according to his will and for his glory. That which is done according to his will and for his glory will abide his presence and be rewarded at the judgment seat of Christ. And so the gold is found heading the list of that which abides the presence of God and will be to his honor and glory as well as your prayer. For then he hath cried me, I shall come forth with hope. Only gold to keep his distance. Let be faithful in our trials and trust in day to day that will produce the gold that will abide his presence and be rewarded by him in that soon coming day of reward.
Psalm 32 and verse 8. Psalm 32 and 8. I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way which thou shalt go. I will guide thee with mine eye. And another text in 1 Corinthians 16. 1 Corinthians 16. And verse 9, 1 Corinthians 16 and 9. For a great door and effectual is open unto me, and there are many adversaries. Now in the last 5 or 6 weeks, we've been speaking on the Lord's leading. That is, in my own personal life, and I've tried to bring out the way the Lord leads, and trusting it'll be a stimulant to all our faith. And as each week I sat down for a little while in the morning to recall some of the things that happened 25, 30 years ago. I've been amazed how freshly they seem to float back out of the past and happy thoughts. And as I reminisce over those days gone by, how God led so definitely. We're going to continue these messages until we end up right here in the hall. The Lord's leading. And if he leads one, he may lead another. And if his leading is my case or some encouragement to you, that's wonderful. So tonight, we want to get back into Raleigh. Last week, you remember, we went down to Newport News and got back to Raleigh where it seems the Lord had simply pointed out that we were to reside. On the way back from Newport News to Raleigh, North Carolina, I didn't have a car at that time. I told you how the Lord stole the one I had before I left Canada. So, on the way back by bus from Newport News to Raleigh, I was riding down, looking out, watching the signs as we approached Raleigh, and I saw a big sign, Sea Rawls for Used Car. Well, I say I didn't have a car, and I realized I needed one. So on arriving back in Raleigh, I began praying about one, and the next day as I was uptown, I saw a car go by, and it was a 1931 Chevrolet maroon and black. Now, that may go back beyond some of you, but many of you remember that year and the cars they drove at that time. But anyway, as I saw that car pass, I thought, that's the kind of car I want, and I just somehow fell for it. So the next day, I was in my room, or not in my room, in the front room of the chapel residence in Raleigh. The chapel had gone out, the chapel was working, it was a pharmacist. So I was in the front room on my knees, praying that the Lord would make it possible for me to have an automobile, for I knew I needed one. Well, I had $75 in my pocket, and I knew that was a long way from buying an automobile, and furthermore, I needed a suit. So while I was on my knees, there was a knock at the door. I got off my knees to answer the door, and this is Herbert Riddle, still alive in Raleigh. She was at the door, and I answered. She said, Mr. Wilson, the Lord has laid something on my heart, and I thought I'd come around and give it to you. She says, here's $50 for you to buy a tower. Help to buy one. Well, now, this is around 29 years ago, and you know what $50 was right then, what it was worth. Why, it was equal to $150 to $200 today. Well, I said, Mrs. Riddle, you know, I was just on my knees praying the Lord would enable me to get an automobile. And I certainly thank you for this. He said, well, I hope you'll be able to, and she left. So the next afternoon, after some more prayer, I thought, well, I'm going uptown, see what I can do. I've got $125. I went to the post office to mail some letters, and as I came out on the other side of the post office, I looked up, and here I saw, on the top of this big building, Rawls Used Car. I thought, that's the sign I saw coming in on the bus the other day. So I went over there, and one of the salesmen walked up to me, and he said, can he help you? I said, well, what kind of used cars have you got? Well, he said, you've got some good used cars. I said, have you got any Chevrolet? Yes, have you got a 1931 Chevrolet? That's just the car I wanted. So we went downstairs, because they all used cars downstairs, and forced that car up to me, and it was a maroon in black. Just exactly what I want. I said, that's the car I want. Well, he said, that's a 6 year old, that car. And he said it was $750. Now, I think of getting a car new for $750. That's what a 1931 Chevrolet cost in 1931. And this is a year later, so. I said, how much do you want for now? Well, he said, let's go for a ride first. And he did. He drove around the block. I said, what do you want for it? He said, do you have a car to trade in? I said, no, I don't have a car. Well, he said, well, we generally have two prices. Or if anyone being in cars knows that, if you've got cash, you get a little cheaper. So if you want to trade in, turn it another price. So he said, well, we'll sell it for $325. Well, I thought that was pretty good. It had 21,000 miles on it. So I said, well, I'll pray about it. So we went upstairs, and I went out on the street in Raleigh and crossed over, and I met Mr. Allen. Now, Mr. David Allen was the one, as you know, that made us a loan on this building. I said, David, I've been over to Rawls, and I'm missing a car over there. They've got a good used car. He said, what kind of car is it? And I told him. Well, he said, you know, I do all my car buying at Rawls. I get a new car there every second year. He said, I also buy trucks for my business. He said, I'll go over and see Mr. Rawls. So he went over and saw Mr. Rawls, and when I came back a couple hours later, Mr. Rawls said, Mr. Wilson, he said, you've had that car for $275, including the license. Well, that was $50 off of the salesman he told me, $325. Well, I said, I'll take it. And he sat down, figured out, he said, the down payment, including the license, is $104. I said, that's fine. So I had my car. When I went down, to drive it away, why, I told the salesman what I was getting it for, and he was mad. He said, I could have got $310 for that this morning. He said, Mr. Rawls wouldn't come down from the price this morning, $325. He said, that was the price. He wouldn't come down. I could have got more than that for this morning. Well, anyway, I got it for $375, including the price. And then, as I say, it cost $104. So I had $21 to buy a suit with. I went uptown and I met one of the assistants there, Mr. Horace Martin. He still is alive in Raleigh. And I said, Horace, if I was practically new around there, I said, where's a good place to buy a suit? Come on over. I'll show you where I buy mine. So he took me over and there was a store operated by a Jew. So finally, looking around, and I saw the suit I wanted and a few pair of trousers. And I said, how much? He says, suit. So Horace took this fellow aside, whispered something to him. And I didn't tell Horace how much money I had. I didn't say anything to anyone. No one knew I just had this $21 in my pocket. So finally, they had a little conversation. I just what Horace said, I don't know, but he came over, and I believe Horace was kind of twisting his arm a little because the suit wasn't too happy. Well, he said,
I'll sell you the suit for $18.50. Keep her at house. I said, thank you. I'll take it. Well, I got home with a car and a suit and $2.50. So I thought I did pretty good. So that was the way I got my car in Raleigh, and that was just one of those many incidents that happened back in those early days. Then we began to get exercise about another place for some meetings. Mr. Chappell already referred to, he was a pharmacist, one of the chief pharmacists in the King Wholesale Drug Company in Raleigh. He used to wait on a lot of doctors and so on that came in there, and a Dr. O.L. Ray, who was head of the Board of Education up there, came into the pharmacy one day, and Mr. Chappell said, Dr. Ray, do you know of any vacant buildings out in the country? He said, like school buildings or community buildings that are available for a campaign. Ray said, what kind of a campaign? Well, he said, an evangelistic campaign. Well, he said, who do you want to preach? Well, he said, there's a young Canadian staying with me. He's been with me now for about a year. And he's going to locate around here. And I was just wondering if there might be a place out in the country, because he wants to get out into the other way places. He said, yes, Dr. Ray said, there's a place right up at Six Forks, only about a half a mile from my home. It used to be a Christian church, but it hasn't been used for 2 years, and the windows are all knocked out. He said, and the dirt jobbers have taken over, the doors are open, and he said, the kids have been in there doing a lot of damage. He said, as far as I know, there's only one elder left of the board of, one deacon of the board of deacons, that church, and that's Mr. Lynn. He used to be church many years ago. And he said, as far as I know, he's the only one who has any faith, though, about that building, but he said, it's in a mess. How long does this fellow want to preach in it? Mr. Chappell says, oh, maybe 6 weeks. And he just roared laughing. He said, why, they couldn't get anybody to go there once a month. How are you going to get anybody there for 6 weeks? And you do well to get people to come in for a week around our place. They just don't go to church, because it was a rural section. Well, Mr. Chappell came home and told me about it, and he went out immediately and contacted this Mr. Lynn, and he said, I don't see any reason why you can't have it. No church has been held there for 2 years, but the building will need a lot of fixing up. So the next Saturday afternoon, a number of the men at Raleigh in the chapel there, and myself, we went out and we went to work cleaning up that building. And some were putting in the glass panes, others were getting all the dirt out of it, and others traps and taking up the seats and washing them. While they were doing that, I was going to a cabinet that was up at the front of the platform. And I came across a card with some other papers and Sunday school papers that had been left there for 2 years. As I looked at it, I said, fellas, look at this. And this is the text. I read it to you here a while ago. A great door and effectual is open unto me, and there are many adversaries. And just then a man stepped into the doorway. And he smiled and said it's the time of day. Come to find out that this denomination that owned this building had sent him down there to try and get that thing going again. I thought, well, sure enough, we've got an adversary right here. After we got permission to use the building, we were cleaning it all up, getting ready to start a campaign. It was way out from Raleigh, about 9 miles. And here's a man sent along by the denomination that practically abandoned the property, and now he wants to get something going and try and revive the old testimony, the old membership. Well, anyway, he had a little talk, and he seemed a little bit disturbed, but he couldn't do much about it. He seemed he'd already got the okay from the only living deacon. We went ahead and started meetings, and for 6 weeks, preached in that church building, the place was packed night after night. And this Dr. O.L. Ray said to me, he had the oldest house for deal one evening, and I think Mrs. Ray got saved in those meetings. He said, Wilson, you know, he said, I was very apprehensive about you having meetings here. I didn't think that people would come out. He said, you know, I only missed one night myself. He said, please. So he didn't think anybody would come for 1 week, let alone six, but he admitted that he enjoyed the Word of God, and there were quite a number saved during that time. I think over 20, 22, if I remember correctly, found Christ during those meetings. I was thinking just before I sat down of one unusual case. His name was Mr. Stevens. They said that whenever Mr. Stevens, he was a farmer living about a half a mile from the old church building, and when you'd hear him out plowing, you could hear him cursing all over the place here. A very loud voice in his old mule, just kind of stubborn at times, and he'd cuss that mule out. And the other farmers, he could hear him almost a mile away, cussing that mule. Well, Mr. Stevens came along to those meetings, and he got saved. And he was a happy soul. After that, they used to hear him singing hymns all over the countryside. It was quite a change, and folks used to say, well, I'll tell you, if any man got changed around here during those campaign meetings, Mr. Stevens did. So remember the day we were going to have the baptismal service that night? We had to have it in Raleigh because we didn't have a baptismal service out there. I went around that morning visiting the young convert, and Mr. Stevens was out in the field. And he was singing, going on down the field with the plow and the mule. I said, Mr. Stevens, you still going to be baptized tonight? He said, amen, brother. He said, if I could get near some water, I'd baptize the mule. He said, I'm going to obey the Lord. He was just that happy. And he found baptism in the Bible, and he was going to be baptized. So they were some of the happy times we had at Fitzwater. Then we went over to Wendell, a place 24 miles east of Raleigh. This was quite a place. It was a community building near a little town called Corinth. And the amazing thing to me is there are so many little villages around there with Bible names. This is a place called Zebulun and a place called Corinth and so on. But we heard about this community. It was a very wicked community. A lot of bootleggers lived there. And they said they didn't go to church. And a lot of fights going on in that community. So we saw this big community building, and it holds about 700 people. There was a service held there once a month, and the people came from quite a distance to hold this service. They had 12 men on the board of deacons, and the only pay that preacher got was his car loaded down with collard greens and potatoes and vegetables like that. He got no money. All he got was vegetables. But he went back home happy, a couple of chickens walking in the back seat along with it. That was his salary. So we got the use of this building. In fact, the preacher and the congregation couldn't say much about it because it was a community building and anyone could preach in it but a Roman Catholic or a communist or a Jehovah's Witness. That was the real. So we got the use of the building and started these meetings. And this preacher used to come for his afternoon service once a month, so there was no conflict at the time. We went right on through Christmas and New Year's. And I think that was 7 weeks. It rained 5 weeks out of the 7. There were 4 miles of dirt road from Wendell over to the church building. And I'm going to tell you, those roads are just a mess. Mr. Allen pulled the battery right off the bottom of his car one night and then stuck in the mud. Yes, there in the mud. He used to see people walking and several nights. He left Raleigh to go out there and about 24 miles or so out there. Actually, I thought it was useless to go. The weather was so bad, and the rain was coming down. It had been raining all day, and I stayed with Jim Chappell and Mrs. Chappell and some of the other fellows going up. We're going to go tonight, Mr. Wilson. I said, I don't see the need of it, but we'll go. If even one person comes, if they're coming out weather like this, they deserve to be treated. You know, we get there and see sometimes as high as 200. And at times, we meet mothers within 2 miles of that church. Rubber boots off, raincoat off, and a bit of an umbrella, and one little child in her arms, or if it was able to walk, it was trudging close to her, and another one trudging behind through the mud, and they had another pair of shoes under the raincoat, and then they got to the big building, they take off their rubber boots and put on the other shoes belonging to the building. And that happened time and time again, walking 2 and 2.5 miles just to hear the gospel, way out in the open country. I thought, well, people are willing to do this to hear the word of God, I'm going to go at the end. There's some tragic things happening there. One night, Mr. Chappell came in and his shoes were quite long. I suppose they were anywhere about 16 feet or 18 feet in length. And the people used to just about come right up near the front. And Mrs. Chappell came in and so they moved over to make room for her. And as she sat down,
she made room for her, and they all seemed to sit down together. That board broke, and as they sat down, the girl next to Mrs. Chappell happened to have her leg back up under, and her leg was broken badly. So we had to have that taken care of. She was carried out of the meeting. Eventually came back before the campaign was over and found the law. She just stopped a murder right across the street from that building. One afternoon I went out visiting. One of those young ladies had found Christ in the farm right across the street, and I thought there was something wrong when I pulled up. I heard some screaming in the house. I heard two or three girls calling, "Go, go, go." Finally, I went around the house, and here I saw a man stained with blood. And he had two big rocks in his hand. He was covered with blood. I said, "What's going on around here?" And then he recognized me. And then he did. Why, the door opened, and there stood the other man, his brother, of these two girls, and he had an axe handle in his hand. And his axe head wasn't on the handle. It was a brand new handle, and it was stained with blood. These two men had gone out, and were both just stained with blood. And it hadn't have been that those two girls succeeded in pulling their brother in and slamming the door on Dudley, there would have been a murder. So they finally got the two of them together, and they decided to call it off. And this one left that community when I was back there and heard him for a month after I checked out, and he hadn't come back. But that was the situation. Then the Lord began to work, and this preacher began getting a little jealous. And I found out he was spreading it around the community that I was a Catholic, and he had attended one or two of the meetings. So I found out the meeting the day he was going to have his service, and I went out. I sat and listened to him, and then when the meeting was over, I went up, and his deacons were gathered around him, and he was a little surprised that I was there. But I walked up to him, and I said, first of all, he said, "How are you, Brooks?" And I said, "I'm all right." I said, "I just want to say this, that I hear that I'm being accused of being a Catholic." I said, "Any man who has heard me preach one sermon and says I'm a Catholic, he doesn't know any more about God's salvation than a hockey puck." Mm-hmm. Of course, the preacher was the one who spread around, he dropped his head. So I didn't say it, but whatever he did, the others didn't call his hand on him. Anyway, the opposition continued. As you said a while ago, there are many adversaries. So one night I received a letter to the effect that if I came out that night and preached, it would cost me my life. As I say, it was a very wicked community, a lot of bootlegging going on, fights and so on. So the chapels were quite perturbed, and they said, "Don't you go?" I said, "Yes, I'm going." So finally, some of the other men came around, of course, Martin I referred to a while ago, and Ed Smith. Finally, Mr. Chappell decided he would go along, and there were five others, seven, myself, and we went out. There weren't many cars in those days. They used those old Hoover carts. Most of the people walked. So we got there. There wasn't anybody in the building. There was crowds milling all around the outside. So we pulled up in the yard, and I said to the fellows, "No," I said, "you just stay out here. I'm going in myself to see what happened." So we went in and walked in the building, and nothing happened. I walked right up to the front, took my foot off, went down on the pew, sat down with my Bible, get ready for meeting, and nothing happened. After a while, some of the others began coming in, and so we got started in the meeting. About 250 people were out that night, and at the end of the service, I said, "Well, evidently, there's some opposition to our having meetings here. Maybe we could find out the cause of that." I said, "I've just been preaching the gospel. I'd like to know who are opposing the preaching of the gospel. Why was my life threatened?" I said, "Would those who are responsible and opposing what I'm preaching stand up?" No one stood up. So then there was a fellow, and he just got off the county road in 5 years, in jail, 5 years in the county road, and he'd been guilty of participation in the murder, a very hard character. He'd been attending the meeting, and he jumped right up on the seat. When no one got up, he got up on the street and he said, "Folks," he said, "I gave this piece of property for the building of this structure," and he said, "to my knowledge, it was to be used for the preaching of the Bible. Also," he said, "for other purposes, community purposes, but no one who is a Catholic or a Seventh or a Jehovah's Witness or a communist could preach here."
Now, he said, I've been coming to these meetings. I'm no Christian. Don't profess to be, but I'm a whole lot better than some of you folks who say you are. Now, he said, I want some of you men who are opposing Mr. Wilson to stand up here. Let's take a look at it. Well, no one dared stand up, and I'm glad they didn't, because the way he was talking, they'd like it in a fight. Anyway, we found out after the meeting, before that service was over, I asked all who wished these meetings to continue, and everybody stood up. There wasn't one who kept their seat. So we continued those meetings. We found out afterwards the reason, and they really meant business, those who wrote that letter. A group of young men about my own age had gotten together when they heard about the threat, and they made known to these men, they said, you lay your hands on Preacher Wilson and he'll take care of you. And there were about 50 men, young folks, who got together and got the Lord used them to prevent any harm or danger. There are a couple of interesting things. These men, when we'd get there, showing how they didn't seem to respect the place, we'd get there at night and they'd all be standing around like sometimes I suppose you'd see these cowboys, and they're standing there with a hat cocked on one side, two in the back, and smoking, sitting on the stove and everything else in cool weather. And none of them were dressed up. They were just in their farm clothes. And they were hard men. Look, some of them didn't look as though they'd seen a razor in 3 weeks. They'd come in there and walk around and jabber and swear and spit and all the rest of it until we were ready to start the meeting. So one night before the meeting, I got up and I said, fellas, I'm surprised at you men. I said, you come in here like a herd of cattle. You have no respect for this place at all. We're preaching the gospel, and I think the gospel deserves reverence. And you come in here, and you stand around the stove, you smoke, and you tell stories, and you sit all over the stove and over the ashes. Well, I said, this is a church building. We're just going to have meetings here. And you should respect. I suppose he took quite a chance in saying that, but you know, it was the most amusing thing. And I think to this day, if you told me to tackle this, you'd just about break his side laugh. The next night, none of those men came in the building until he got up to see if he'd open him. And then they start in. That fellow got up in the shoes. As soon as they got inside the door, they take their hats off. And then on tiptoe and not a word on them, and they all sit right up front about the first 2 or 3 rows. Those fellas came night after night. I never saw one of them saved, but I saw many of them standing and weeping. Now, whether any of them have gotten saved since, only God knows. But I'm going to tell one more incident in this connection, and then our time's almost up now, as it is. But when we went there, one of those 12 deacons, an old fellow, couldn't read nor write. And he came up to me 2 or 3 nights after the campaign got started. He said, Mr. Wilson, he says, you know, I know what you're talking about. 40 years ago, he said, I was saved in the cornfield. I could take you to the very spot, he says, where I got saved, where I trust the Lord, and I know I was saved. And I've known it for 40 years. And I can't read the Bible. And I know, he says, when it's been preached. And I think he was the only one of those 12 people that knew Christ. So, he said to me one night, he said, of course, I don't have any money, but, he said, I'd like to do something for these people. I'd love to hear the word for you. He said, who put the kerosene in these lamps? Well, there were about 12 kerosene lamps that lit up that building. Well, I said, as of now, I couldn't tell you. It's only been going on about 3 nights, and I know who put the kerosene. He says, can I do it? Well, I said, we'd be happy for you to do that. If you want to do it, it's unto the Lord. He said, yeah, I'll be glad to do that unto the Lord. I want to do my part. So it was a little kind of a community store about 2 miles down the crossroads. They sold gas and groceries. This old fellow Poker, he was saying, man, I suppose, about 65 at that time. And he used to go down and get a gallon of gas and a 5-gallon can. And about every 3 or 4 nights, he'd go down with his can and get a gallon of gas. Well, they have never known a revival to go longer than 1 week out there. So he had gone on, and he get his gallon of gas and come back, and he went on 2 weeks, and I announced the 4th week. And so he went on down after I announced that it was going on the 5th week. He went down the Monday night and said, I want some more gas, more kerosene.
The man says, how much longer is that fellow going to preach up there? And he says, and how much thirsty do you want to stop? He says, fill up the can, he's going to preach till Jesus comes. So, anyway, the old fellow was quite enthusiastic, and since then he's gone home to the Lord. So there get some of the experiences we had in our early days in Raleigh, North Carolina, and around there. Now, next week we'll continue on our work around Raleigh, and then we'll move on to the next.